Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Robert Perry. He's an award-winning reporter, founder of the investigative website ConsortiumNews.com, and author of the book Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
This book could well be called The Disastrous Performance of the News Media Before and During the Presidency of George W. Bush. You point out in many examples throughout the book that the mainstream media here's one example, to harshly criticize Democrats and apply much more lenient standards to Republicans. What are some examples of this?
Well, I think perhaps the clearest example was the way that Al Gore was treated during the campaign in 2000. He was not only attacked by the right-wing media, which, of course, has become very powerful and expansive over the years, but he was vilified by the New York Times and the Washington Post in their news columns. There were repeated cases in which Gore's comments were taken out of context or simply just misquoted. He never did say he invented the internet. He was accused of claiming that he was the one who discovered the Love Canal case when that wasn't what he said. It's clear from any fair reading or fair listening to the tape of him talking to some students in Concord, New Hampshire, about how he was involved in some of that wastewater treatment cleanup, that he wasn't claiming to have discovered Love Canal, but that's the way it was presented to the American people. So you had numerous cases where someone like Gore had to go through the slings and arrows of the media trying to show it wasn't liberal. Whereas on the other side, George Bush and Dick Cheney were allowed to play very fast and loose with the truth. There was an interesting case during the vice presidential debate in 2000 when Dick Cheney insisted that his fortune at Halliburton had not been involved with the U.S. government, that the U.S. government had not helped him in making his money, and that simply wasn't true. He had not only received the benefit of Halliburton being a big defense contractor, but he had personally lobbied for loan guarantees that helped Halliburton's bottom line and thus Cheney's bankroll. That was pointed out at the time, but was never picked up on by the mainstream media, even as Dick Cheney was accusing Al Gore of puffing up his own resume. Cheney was the one who was actually puffing up his resume and was never called on it. So that's the sort of double standard that we came almost to get used to in that period, and it's continued through to the present.
Why the double standard?
Well, I think a lot of it goes back to the 1970s, and I arrived in Washington in 1977 with the Associated Press, and during the 1980s did some of what became known as the Iran-Contra scandal, and went on to Newsweek and then PBS Frontline. So I've seen a lot of this firsthand. But if you go back to the mid-1970s, after Watergate, after the end of the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers and other examples of the press actually doing its job and telling the public what was going on, the right wing and, generally speaking, the Republicans felt they were being unfairly treated. They thought that Richard Nixon had been driven out of the White House unfairly. They felt that the press had undermined the war effort in Vietnam. So they began an effort, and you can trace it back to the late 70s, of concentrating large sums of money somewhat through foundations, conservative foundations, also through wealthy right-wing individuals, into media. They built up their own media infrastructure. They also supported groups that went after reporters in the mainstream press who wouldn't toe the line. So if you were digging up stories that, for instance, made the Reagan administration look bad, you would be targeted with smear campaigns and other ways of pressuring you. So and that really led to reporters losing their jobs or having their careers badly damaged.
Did that happen to you?
Yeah, to some extent, sure. I mean, it happened to a lot of people. But when I was doing the stories about the Contras and the Nicaraguan Contras and some of their abuses, I came under increasingly heavy attack. My patriotism was questioned. Stories would be gone through with a fine-tooth comb, looking for something that could be made an issue out of. That sort of thing was fairly common. There were also smear campaigns done against some journalists. For instance, some of the women journalists in Central America, and that was really the first American conflict where women played a major role in actually reporting a war. And some of these groups up in Washington, including people working for the State Department, would put out stories about women sleeping with Sandinistas and being biased, and they damaged people's careers that way. And the overall result, though, as we go through that period and come into the 90s, was that, first of all, a lot of good people were pushed aside as journalists. The ones that remained learned a lesson not to go into these kinds of stories. There was a very strong feeling by the time you get to the early 90s that it was important to be tougher on a Democrat when Bill Clinton came in than any Republican. And the main goal of the press, the mainstream press, was to prove it wasn't liberal. And so you saw this, by the time Clinton became president, there was a merger almost of interests with the mainstream press wanting to show that it wasn't liberal and attacking Clinton excessively on some of these minor scandals, and the right-wing press, which by then had grown to be a very powerful force, newspapers, magazines, increasingly talk radio. By the mid-1990s, Fox News had come online. So you had this enormously powerful right-wing press. You had an intimidated or collaborationist mainstream press at that point, willing to go along with the right, and you had people who were trying to stand up to it being isolated and attacked by these right-wing pressure groups inside the media. The cumulative effect of that was devastating, and by the time you get to 2000, a lot of that was taken out on Al Gore, and it was also it really set up the stage for George Bush becoming president. And then once 9/11 happened, this almost unified effort to make him seem like a stronger, more effective president than he was, leading into the Iraq War.
Why do you think there was not the parallel liberal or democratic pressure on the media to tell its story?
Well, that's a good question. I think in part it goes back to that same time in the mid-1970s when I think maybe liberals or people on the progressive side felt that the mainstream press would do the work for them. They didn't have to really invest in that. They could invest in other things. They could, for instance, help feed the poor. They could help buy up endangered wetlands, more direct projects like that. They did not see the strategic need in building a media infrastructure that would balance off what the right was doing. And then it almost became a kind of dogma on the left in the United States, where there was a sense that I talked to some of the wealthy progressives, even in the late 80s, early 90s, as I was becoming aware of this problem, and they would say, "Oh, we don't do media." That was sort of their flippant response. And as you know, since you work with a media outlet, it's very difficult to get the kind of significant funding support that the right has been able to put together. And it's not that progressives don't have the money. You have some very wealthy progressives who operate in Hollywood, for instance, whose money really comes from being part of the media, mostly the entertainment side, but they have not been willing to make the kind of investment that, say, Rupert Murdoch has made or a Reverend Sun Myung-moon, the South Korean theocrat who has financed the Washington Times and a number of right-wing magazines. You just don't have that. There's a sense that the mainstream press is supposed to do the work itself. It's not realistic. And sadly, what's been allowed to happen is a tremendous imbalance has been created, an asymmetry, if you will, in how the right now has a great ability to take minor issues and make them into major scandals. And vice versa, things that really should be more significant are downplayed or ignored by the press. We've seen that even recently with the Move On ad, it was a rather juvenile ad, but to make the general betray us become the focal point of the public debate in Congress, when the larger issue is the course of this disastrous war in Iraq. Shows how the right can take small things and make them big, and big things and make them small. and the mainstream press goes along.
One of the big things that the press made small was the 2000 election. And you talk about this in some detail in your book, Neck Deep. Tell us, here's an example that I found interesting. Tell us about the Brooks Brothers riot.
Well, it's really one of the most extraordinary moments in, I think, recent American political history, was that as the recount battle was taking shape in Florida, which was very decisive in election 2000, and as people remember, the vote totals were very close, and in fact, Bush's lead kept disappearing. It went down and down and down, got down to a few hundred. And so there was an effort to have recounts in several cities, including Miami. And the, what we now know is that Republicans in Congress organized teams of people, activists from Capitol Hill mostly, and sent them down to Florida, paid their way, put them in hotels, and then let them and sprung them loose on these recount efforts. And in the case of the recount in Miami, there was effectively a riot when there was an effort by the election board to do the count. These Republican activists dressed very nicely. That's why they became known as the Brooks Brothers rioters. Came charging down the hallway, pounding on the doors, and the canvassing board stopped its recount. And the recount was never really resumed in any meaningful way after that. And this was considered quite a success by the Republicans. And the next night, there was actually a celebration at one of the hotels in the Miami area, in which George Bush and Dick Cheney called in to congratulate the rioters at the expense of the Bush campaign. Wayne Newton was brought in to sing for these people. He sang Dankeschön, which means, of course, thank you very much in German. And this behavior was then also reflected in when Bush was finally, about a year or so later, forced to release the financial records for the recount campaign. We found in them that the expense of this operation had been paid by his organization. In other words, the Bush campaign had paid to bring rioters across state lines to interfere with an election recount.
Now, that's a story, and it's a story that I never even read until I read your book.
Well, it's a pretty remarkable event, but there was an effort at that time by the mainstream media, including like the Washington Post, to play down the bitterness of this recount. And effectively, the thinking was, the conventional wisdom in Washington was that George Bush was the unifier, that Al Gore was the divider. One of the Washington Post's most prominent columnists, Richard Cohen, wrote an article saying that it was important that George Bush get the nod on the Florida election, not whether he'd won the most votes or not, because he was the guy who could bring the country together, and Al Gore would divide the nation. That was the perception at the time. It turned out, obviously, not to be true. George Bush has become a very divisive president, and he'd been very divisive going into that election. But the conventional wisdom, as purveyed through the New York Times, the Washington Post, as well as the more conservative media, was that George Bush was the uniter, not the divider. It wasn't true, but that's what people were told.
We're talking to Robert Perry, the author of Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Another story you tell is of the darker side of Colin Powell, the first Secretary of State under George W. Bush. And your writing about him goes all the way back to the Iran-Contra affair.
Well, it goes back even further to Vietnam.
That's right.
But the simple reality about Colin Powell is that he was never the hero that he was made out to be. He was really an opportunist, and if you understood his history, going back to his days in Vietnam and even both as a young officer, as an advisor in 63, and then later in 68 as as an executive officer for the AmeriCal division, where he helped steer an early investigation away from the My Lai massacre. What you see is a guy who always put his career first. And then, of course, I follow this through an area that I know more about, which is, of course, the Iran-Contra affair. And what I did with that was I took the depositions that had been done but largely ignored, almost entirely ignored, of Pentagon officials who described how those missiles got to Iran. And what comes out of those depositions is a remarkable story about how Colin Powell played the central role in the Iran-Contra scandal that was largely missed, almost entirely missed at the time. He was, without him, without his very clever way of pulling strings and manipulating matters inside the Pentagon, those missiles probably never would have gotten to Iran. And the Iran-Contra scandal might never have happened, at least as we knew it. There were people in the Pentagon who said if they knew what Powell was up to, they knew where the missiles were going, they would have stopped it. But Powell was a very clever bureaucrat and was able to essentially jerry-rig the system so the missiles could get to Iran without other people in key spots in the Pentagon knowing. So you have Powell playing various roles that most Americans don't know about, but which explain why he was so favored by both the Reagan-Bush crowd in those period of the 1980s and early 90s, and then later by the Bush-Cheney crowd. He had proved to be a very useful operative for them. And when you juxtapose that against his behavior during the Iraq war buildup, things suddenly make sense. It's not this anomaly where Powell, for some reason, goes off and gives this false testimony to the United Nations. It really is part and parcel of his whole career. I think if one understands that, one has a much fuller sense of the history of this period.
Let's talk about Vice President Dick Cheney. He's another character with a long history that tends not to be remembered or written about in the press. His history in presidential politics also goes back to the 80s and before.
Right, and I've known Dick Cheney on a somewhat of a personal level since the early 1980s. I was the Associated Press pool reporter that went with a congressional delegation down to Grenada after the U.S. invasion of Grenada in '83, and Cheney was one of the Republican leaders on that, and I spent some time with him then. And I dealt with him during the Iran-Contra period. He was a very important figure in the Congress. Of course, his history had been as a senior official in the White House during the Ford administration. So he had seen some of the efforts to rein in the imperial presidency of Richard Nixon, and he didn't like it. And he represented, even when he was in Congress, the view that the executive should have pretty much total free rein, especially relating to foreign policy matters. And during Iran-Contra, he put together what was known as the Minority Report, which was signed off on by most of the Republicans on the Iran-Contra investigation. And it was written in part by David Addington, who's now Cheney's chief of staff. And it's a very important document for understanding where they went under the Bush II presidency, because it showed that Cheney and Addington and others envisioned the presidency not being something that could be challenged or controlled by Congress when it came to matters of national security or foreign policy. What's happened with as that sort of was put into play in the early 2000 period, what we've seen is, of course, an expansion of presidential power beyond even what we were seeing in the 1980s. But it is true that the Iran-Contra affair can best be understood as a kind of precursor to what we have now. It was the beginning of this return of the imperial presidency, the reassertion of the kind of executive powers that we had seen under Nixon. There had been this period when that had been pushed back, but that pushback was blunted by the 1980s. And by the time you get to Bush II, and especially after the 9/11 crisis, then you start seeing the presidents coming back in full bore. So what we're seeing really was an interesting transition through our recent history, which I think also has been missed by most people in the news media, where you really had a something happening in the 70s to try to stop this problem, the Iran-Contra being the important point where that was reversed, and then that accelerating when you get into the George W. Bush presidency.
So after 9/11 2001, we saw the emergence, as you're talking about, of the Bush Doctrine. What did this mean in terms of foreign policy, and then in terms of domestic policy? Let's start with foreign policy.
Well, the Bush Doctrine held that whatever the President of the United States felt was necessary to protect the country could and would be done, that there were no limits, in effect, that if it required invading a country, whether or not the United Nations approved or whether there was a truly strong case, you could still do it, and that Bush was asserting his right to do it. There was an important speech he gave at West Point, which laid out, in effect, this idea of this unilateral power that he could exert around the world in defense of U.S. national security interests as he saw them. So you had that. That also had other components, however, including this idea of using information or misusing information, if you will, to make those cases seem more plausible and reasonable than they actually were. And there was the domestic side of this, that if you accept this idea, which was laid out by the Bush administration after 9/11, that there was a war on terror that had no boundaries, that it existed literally every place in the world, including the United States, and that it had no end, that it was indefinite. And this was a very important change in the other cases where presidents have exerted extraordinary executive power. For instance, when Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, suspended habeas corpus in some areas, even though that, in a sense, was envisioned by the Constitution, which talks about a time of rebellion or insurrection. That was a case where the area, the geographical area, was limited and the time was limited. The war was going to end. In the case of Franklin Delano Roosevelt imprisoning or detaining Japanese Americans, while that may have been a fairly outrageous abuse of power, it was at least a defined in terms of time that when the war was over, this was going to end. So the idea of an emergency action, which many Americans could understand, whether it's justified or not, they could certainly see, well, in the case of a crisis, sometimes you have to do things that the Constitution may not particularly smile upon, but you may have to do it. But those were all limited. In the case of what Bush was laying out, the reason it was so extraordinary and is so extraordinary is that he's saying that this war is everywhere. In other words, it is within the United States as well as outside, and that it has no time limit. And if you put that and juxtapose it with his theories about the so-called plenary powers of a president in wartime, and plenary in this case means full or total, that it effectively means that the whole idea of inalienable rights for citizens has been wiped out. Because if the president has all the power, can do whatever he wants, he can waive habeas corpus, he can order torture, he can order executions, he can basically do whatever he feels is necessary. There are no rights for the person who is being targeted in this way. Then we have a whole different system. And it's not just an emergency moment where you might do this for a week or two or a couple of years even. It is supposed to go on indefinitely. They talk about the long war. They talk about a war that will last a generation or more. In effect, it's an endless war because terrorism will never be fully stopped.
Well, not only that,
but acknowledge that.
When you, as you've talked about in your book, when you have a war on a tactic as opposed to on a country or political group of some kind, it makes it very amorphous. And also, when you use that tactic yourself, then the whole thing becomes almost nonsensical.
Right. Terrorism is obviously it's almost in the eye of the beholder. In a classical definition, it is violence that is used to achieve a political result against civilians. So you could take and say, well, that's at least a defined definition, a clear definition. But what's happened is it's used selectively. So when you have, for instance, in the case of some of the right-wing Cuban Americans who operate out of Miami, and some of them are still there, when they've engaged in in violence against civilians to achieve a political end, i.e. undermining the Castro regime in Cuba, the United States has protected them. And there are people even recently, like Luis Posada Carriles, who was a Cuban terrorist who engaged in a long history of this, including some things fairly recently, and has been protected by the Bush administration once he came into the United States. He's now essentially on bail. There's some proceedings that are still going on, but he has not been treated like a quote terrorist would be if the person was somehow attached to Al-Qaeda or somehow considered a radical Islamist. Kinds of people are given one treatment, but the people that work in sort of more hand in glove with what the U.S. policy has been, even though they've committed acts of terrorism by definition, are treated differently.
But also, I mean, in Iraq, some of the tactics that are used by American soldiers or contractors include rape, pillage, you know, looting, and torture.
Well, right.
Which are themselves forms of terrorism.
Correct. And there are different kinds of terrorism in the sense that you have governments who engage in terroristic activities. And that may be a little bit different in the sense that obviously war is you have rules of war and you can violate those rules of war. You can commit terrorism within the rules of war, I suppose. Or you can talk about groups that are sort of non-governmental and them carrying out certain acts of terrorism. That's what I think of in the more classic sense. But there's no question that if the United States doesn't punish soldiers who engage in those kinds of activities, and if those activities are in a sense tolerated or encouraged, then you could argue fairly that the United States government is at least aiding and abetting or tolerating terrorism. We've seen cases in some places where there have been efforts to punish those still soldiers, but in others, especially when you get up into the higher levels, if it's not just the night guards at Abu Ghraib, but when it gets into the officers above them, and the officers are let go and not punished, as we've seen recently, whereas the lower level grunts who happen to have been caught on film doing some of these things, they're sent off for long prison terms. So you're having a bit of a mixed situation where in certain embarrassing situations where the evidence is clear and overwhelming, the Bush administration has acted. But in other cases where the situation is a little more ambiguous, instead of an aggressive effort to punish people, there's been the opposite, which is to let them go.
We're talking to Robert Perry, author of the book Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Another free ride that the press seemed to give George W. Bush was an acceptance of his lack of foreign policy experience, giving him credit for, quote unquote, instinct and decisiveness. To what extent were Bush's instincts at work in his foreign policy versus the plans and thinking of a group of neoconservative politicians that were behind him?
Well, certainly the neoconservatives have essentially laid out the map that's been followed. And some of that also goes back to this earlier period. When I was covering the Central America wars in the 1980s, I encountered many of the neoconservatives, people like Elliot Abrams, and who was Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, Robert Kagan, who was head of what was known as the Public Diplomacy Office at State. So I knew a number of these fellows personally, and they were very smart and very good with words. They also had this attitude that they should manipulate the American people. And they had a concept which we started hearing about, and at first the words were even classified. Later they were treated less sensitively. But the words were perception management. They felt it was very important to manage the perceptions of the American people. And the key to that was to control the information flows. So they went after the press, tried to throttle what we could do. They also went after the intelligence community back in the 80s, trying to intimidate the CIA analysts who were seeing things differently. They were seeing a decline in the Soviet Union. They were seeing that they were not alarmist about the threat from, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. They weren't towing the line either. So there was an effort to purge the CIA and to intimidate the mainstream press, which went along very effectively. So the neocons developed that theory. They also wanted to exert this unilateral power of the United States, especially after the end of the Cold War. And they had a particular interest in the Middle East, where they saw Israel as the standard bearer of Western values, and they saw the Muslim countries as rather backward and primitive. So there was this effort to impose various kinds of U.S. domination in this area, and they put together strategies and arguments and made their case and twisted the information when needed. And that went on through the 90s and into the current presidency, where they were brought back in into key jobs when George W. Bush returned. So you had that element. You had the neocons, the neocons that are presenting a kind of intellectual framework. And then you had Bush, who was, in many ways, after 9/11, there was an effort by the mainstream press and the conservative press to kind of buck him up. The feeling was that he had to be given a lot more confidence so he could handle this very difficult situation. There was almost no criticism of Bush that followed 9/11. It was a very strange period where, despite some of the facts which would have indicated a shaky leader, he was treated almost like he was chosen by God. In fact, there's in the book Neck Deep, I cite this interview that Tim Russert did with Laura Bush and Rudy Giuliani, and there was a Catholic cardinal involved. This was in late 2001, where Russert asked this question, suggesting that George Bush was picked by God to represent the United States at this very difficult time. And the only person on the panel who disagreed was Laura Bush, who said that's not how God works. But Giuliani went on and talked about, I have to disagree with the First Lady here. And so there was this deification of Bush, and that fed into his ego. He began to see himself that way almost. So I think what might have been considered somewhat a well-meaning effort by the media to shed its objectivity and its professional duties, and instead sort of be patriotic and to bolster the president at this difficult time, actually went against the interests of the American people in fundamental ways. It created an image of Bush that he then took on as his own, which was that he was infallible, that his gut, his instincts were perfect, and in fact, some people would say that he had the right stuff, the right man, as one of the titles, one of the books at the time said, because he wasn't burdened down with all this knowledge and information and nuance. He could see things with moral clarity was the phrase, and he could take these actions decisively without having to worry about all the things that folks who knew too much would worry about. So his ignorance was almost made into a positive. The results, I think, are now much more evident. But that was a big chunk of what the mainstream media was doing in the months and years after 9/11.
So now you fast forward to the present in Iraq, where we have essentially anarchy, a full-on Iraqi resistance to the occupation by the United States. You have thousands of Americans who are dead, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who are dead, of no apparent political or economic gains except for, you know, to those who profit from war. You've got a whole world against us. When you look at the big picture, do you see incompetence or do you see intent? And if there's intent in this, what is the intent?
Well, there's some intent in that the view of the neoconservatives was to take out Iraq as a powerful Arab state. The concern was that Saddam Hussein was an Arab leader who had a powerful military and who could cause some trouble in that region. And to replace him with essentially an American colony was considered a smart strategy in a geopolitical way. The thinking also was that once Iraq was taken, that the U.S. would move on and force regime change in Syria and Iran. The neocon joke in 2002 was after taking Baghdad, should they go east or west? And the joke was, real men go to Tehran. And so that was their attitude. And the thinking was that once they took Iran and Syria, that they could then roll up Hezbollah and Hamas as enemies of Israel and effectively gain control of that whole region and essentially put in Arab governments that would be amenable to whatever the United States wanted. It, of course, proved to be a delusion that it was not going to be nearly that easy, but they certainly thought it would. They talked about the cakewalks into Iraq and so forth. But so there was a strategy. There was an intent. And by devastating Iraq, they, in a way, they have achieved a little bit of that. Iraq is certainly not, in a conventional military sense anyway, a threat to anybody at this point. There might be a threat from terrorism or the rise of Islamic militancy coming as a reaction to Iraq, but that's a bit different. So that was the rational, if there was a rational element, that's what it was. It was to try to restructure the Middle East in that way. It wasn't much to put in democracy. That's the phrase they keep using. It was really to put in compliant governments. That was the key. They didn't want democracy to lead to more radical governments, which has happened in a couple of places where there's been where there have been free elections in the Middle East. The idea was to achieve a kind of controlled democracy, if you will. Since it didn't pan out that way, what's been created is a really insoluble situation where the troubles in Iraq have increased the likelihood of regional instability and possible dangers, not only to U.S. interests, but also to Israel. So there's been this boomerang effect that was not really anticipated, but has certainly come to pass.
In light of that, what do you think the saber rattling in Iran is really all about?
Well, I think there's a strong element within the Bush White House and the administration that believes that there has to be an attack on Iran before much longer. President Bush has vowed that he will not leave office with Iran on the march or on the move toward getting a nuclear weapon. There have been more recent stories, but you know, I was writing about this at our website, consortiumnews.com, going back to early this year, when it was becoming increasingly apparent to some of my sources that there was a serious move toward a U.S. airstrike against Iran, that was very much on the table. It was not just bluff. There have been problems that Bush has had in achieving that, mostly that the U.S. high command, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has been resistant to this approach. They think it will be disastrous. They think it would put in danger the U.S. troops in Iraq because it might unleash the pro-Iranian Shiite forces inside Iraq to attack American troops. So there's been a sense that it's not the way to go, but Bush has continued to keep it as very much a live option on the table. So I don't think these things are entirely bluffs. There is maybe an element of that, wishful thinking perhaps, that Iran will fold its cards on its nuclear program. But if it doesn't, there's a real chance still that in the next several months there might be some kind of escalation in a military way.
You talked a few minutes ago about George Bush feeling that he was ordained by God to be president. You talked also about, in the book, about coded signals that only evangelical Christians were able to understand that were in many of his speeches. And I find myself wondering about the whole question of the Christian, quote-unquote Christian element in this presidency. There are evangelical Christians now who feel that they were used by the Republicans, who aren't living up to what their programs and standards are. But then there's also this whole question of apocalyptic thinking. When you have a Middle East policy that looks the way it does now, and when you have the possibility of a war with a country like Iran, you wonder whether they're not actually trying to bring on the apocalypse. What's your thought about this? What is the role of that kind of end-time Christian thinking in this administration?
Well, I think it's one of the great mysteries about George W. Bush, whether he actually believes in some of this this extreme version of Christianity or is just playing it. In the book, we go back to his father's run for the presidency in 1988. And at that, there was a fellow by the name of George Weed, who was an evangelical leader, who put together a program, essentially, for Poppy Bush, the father, to appeal to the evangelical community. And it called for things like inserting certain words and comments and references in speeches that would be understood by the evangelical community as appealing to them, but would be missed by the rest of the population, more or less. Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, refused to use it, in effect. He felt he did not want to manipulate religion for political ends in quite that crass a way. But his son, George W. Bush, who was an advisor, was working on the campaign, got hold of the memo, and according to Weed, said, "I can use this to win Texas." So he had this idea that he could play these games, follow this game plan to achieve a victory with the folks in Texas, and went ahead and proceeded with this style. So some of this seems to be manipulative, calculating, if you will, aimed at this body of voters that who are particularly influential in the Republican Party but are important nationally. It was then expanded to deal with the national campaign in 2000, and Bush has tried to hold on to that religious right group very tightly, and has appealed to them in a variety of ways during his presidency. So you have that. You also have the question of whether Bush has come to believe much of this himself, whether his vision of Christianity has overcome any sense of kind of reason that he would see himself as essentially God's vessel to achieve these ends, these political ends. So when you mix all that together, and again, I'm not quite sure where the manipulation and calculation ends and the true belief begins. It's kind of still a murky area that I don't think people who are, unless they're very, very close to George W. Bush, would have any way of knowing. And even those people, I'm not sure know. I think that's the question in terms of whether or not there'll be this idea that sometime maybe we are in the end times, maybe the apocalypse is upon us. It's certainly something that should be understood, because if that is driving U.S. foreign policy, it's a very dangerous element. When you get beyond reason and start going into pure faith and even this kind of strange doctrine, that could really lead to the end of the world. And the rest of the public should have a say in it, I would think.
When you have a small group of people running a nation, as we do, who are consolidating power in the executive branch to the extent that they have done, one would think that there would be a plan to hold on to that. How do you see that in terms of the reality that we have a Democratic election coming up in just a little over a year?
Well, that's a good question. Clearly, the thinking was, as this presidency developed, that there would be a permanent Republican majority. That's what Karl Rove expressed. It's what I think Bush was trying to achieve. And the thinking was that the Democrats would be kept around, but in sort of a permanent minority status. There was talk that they would be almost like pets. They would be neutered pets, that they would be kept there to keep the appearance of democracy, but without any real opportunity to really exchange power. There'd be this permanent conservative control of the federal government. And that was the thinking, and it was what Roe was acting on and felt he could achieve. We see some of the more recent scandals reflecting on that, particularly the so-called prosecutor scandal, where federal prosecutors are being replaced if they didn't toe the line on certain on bringing charges that might help Republicans achieve election victories. So you had that thinking. Now, it reached a point, however, that the mess in Iraq had gotten so out of hand, and then, of course, the Hurricane Katrina disaster unmasked the Bush administration for its incompetence. Those combined factors, with a slight emergence of a more assertive, you might say, liberal media that is Jon Stewart on the Comedy Central, some of the progressive radio talk shows that began to sort of get a footing in 2005.
And Democracy Now.
And places, groups like Democracy Now, which of course is an older group, but it has been very important in terms of trying to expand beyond just the Pacifica radio stations into a wider number of various outlets and doing some TV. So you had these combined factors and the internet stepping up a little more. That was enough to, I think, alert many Americans, combined with just the reality they were looking at, to begin to have doubts about this presidency. And that set up the stage for the Democrats' rather surprising victory in 2006. Certainly very few people thought it would be as sweeping as it turned out to be. That doesn't mean, however, that those gains are permanent. The media infrastructure situation is still heavily weighted to the right. Some of the progressive inroads have actually been reversed. Air America, for instance, this effort to have a national 24/7 progressive talk radio network has suffered some serious financial blows. They went into bankruptcy for a while and came out with still not enough money to have the kind of impact they might want to. So you have a very fluid situation where it has not been resolved, but certainly the Republicans were dealt a setback in 2006. Bush has shown, however, in 2007, that despite that, he can continue to consolidate his power based on the fear that still is there, whether residual or real, on the part of the Democrats. For instance, when it came to the August recess in 2007, Democrats were afraid they'd be accused of undermining the warrantless wiretapping program, and so they rushed through this Protect America Act, which expanded even more Bush's powers to do wiretapping inside the United States and elsewhere. So it's not clear that this is moving entirely in the Democrats' direction. We'll have to see what happens in 2008, but it's not a done deal. Many Democrats I talk to think they pretty much have it wrapped up. They're almost measuring their curtains for 2009. It probably is a mistake if they think it's that certain development. There are a lot of reasons to not count out the Republicans by any means.
You end the book with a chapter called End of the Republic? It's hard for those of us brought up with principles of democracy founded on the system of checks and balances to really see an end to that system. What would it take at this point, do you think, to bring it into balance?
Well, I think the point is that we really have seen a change in our system of government from certainly from what the founders envisioned as a republic where reason would dominate. There'd be the rule of law. There were checks and balances. There were a whole variety of ways to ensure that that both the executive be kept in check and that citizens have what was known as inalienable rights. That there was no way that the president could have you taken off the street and imprisoned. You had just certain basic rights, and they weren't necessarily going to get you free if you were guilty of something, but he'd have to bring charges. He'd have to go through the process. He'd have to essentially make the case. And this, of course, goes back to the Magna Carta in the 13th century. It's not like a new concept. It's something that's been part of English law for hundreds of years, and was placed in the heart of the Constitution. It's not in the Bill of Rights even. It's in the Constitution itself. Plus, the Bill of Rights added a number of more details and more expansion on some of these ideas of rights for citizens. Now, what we've seen happen under the Bush presidency. In a way, you could trace it back further through the Cold War as some of these rights were eroded by the growth of the power of the presidency. But certainly by the point we're in now, essentially, if one accepts Bush's vision, and it's accepted, by the way, by at least four of the current nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court, so his view is not completely unsupported by powerful people. In fact, one change in the U.S. Supreme Court could effectively end the Constitution as we have historically known it. But the point that Bush has made is that he at this time of war, an endless war with no boundaries, that he has all power as the plenary powers of commander-in-chief, the unitary executive, that he is the one who decides everything. If he wants to take you off the street and lock you up because he thinks you're an enemy combatant, he can do it. And you have no rights to challenge him. You have no right to have your day in court. If he wants to torture you to get information, he can do it. That's his claim of power. Now, whether or not he can make it stick is still in play, and I think that's the hope we have for those of us who believe in a democratic republic, that there can be a way to roll this back, that it's not completely lost. But at the current stage, if you took the current state of law, it's an extremely dark moment for those of us who believed in those things we were taught in the fifth grade, the ideas of inalienable rights, and that citizens, whatever they, how unpopular they may be, whatever race or religion they were, they had certain rights. Now we're being told, not really, that most of you are okay because we're not going to go after everybody, but if we want to pick off this person or that person or even hundreds of people, if we want to waive your Fourth Amendment rights and spy on you, we can do that too. We don't have to show probable cause of anything. These are the messages that really come through if you look at the Bush administration as we try to neck deep as a whole. Many of these stories have been written piecemeal, but they have not been put together in this sort of comprehensive way. And I think if you see the whole panorama, it's a very troubling image indeed.
Well, we are out of time now. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking to Robert Perry, author of the book Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website Santa Fe Radio Cafe, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.